The Bible, turn again please to 1 Corinthians 15 that we read from a few minutes ago. And we're just going to focus this morning on two verses from within that passage, and those are verses 25 and 26, where the Apostle Paul writes, "For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death." These verses are about the risen Christ. Verse 25, you'll notice, features four pronouns. He is there twice, and his is there twice, and in each case, it's the risen Christ that's being talked about. And so, as we grapple with what Paul says here about the risen Christ, we're going to do so under four headings. And first of all, a powerful dislike. That's our first heading, a powerful dislike. Now, I'm sure that within this room, there are widely varying tastes and preferences and predilections. Spicy food is probably loved by some, but hated by others. Jazz music probably attracts and repels in equal measure. The idea of reading Shakespeare probably excites one section of the congregation and evokes painful memories of secondary school for another section. And so we could go on, couldn't we, with lots of things that would receive a mixture of responses within this room. Favourable responses and unfavourable responses. Acceptance and rejection. Affection and dislike. But there's one thing that we would all agree on. One thing that we would all respond to in the same way. One thing that we would all respond to with fierce dislike. And that thing is death. Death doesn't divide opinion. Death doesn't force us human beings into two camps, those who hate it and those who love it. I'm always amazed when I encounter people who love spiders, who find spiders cute and cuddly and charming. It baffles me. I can't believe such people exist, but they do, and those I've encountered seem, on the whole, to be normal people in their right mind. But no one in their right mind loves death. No one finds it cute and cuddly and charming. No, death is just disruptive and devastating and merciless. Death shatters relationships. Death breaks hearts. Death wastes the potential that a living person offers. Death strips us human beings of our dignity and reduces us to the level of the hedgehogs and pigeons that you see splattered on the road as you're driving. Birds and animals die, and so do we. What a tragedy. What a desperately hideous reality. Everyone feels it. I'm saying here is an aversion that is common to all of us. Here is a dislike that we all share, our severe dislike of death. And what I want to say to you now is that someone else also shares that dislike. The risen Christ does. He views death in a very particular way. Notice that verse 25 refers to his enemies. And verse 26 then refers to death as an enemy. And verse 26 must be read in the light of verse 25. In other words, death is not some unspecified person's enemy. Death indeed is not our enemy. At least that's not what Paul means here. No, verse 26 is saying that death is in the category that has just been mentioned in the previous verse. It's one of his enemies, the risen Christ's enemies. And so, as I say, the risen Christ views death in a very particular way. He views it as his enemy. The risen Christ views death as his enemy. And he doesn't blindly view death as his enemy. like a child growing up in some fiercely Geordie part of Newcastle and regarding people from Sunderland as the enemy, even though he's never actually met anyone from Sunderland. Christ's dislike of death is not like that. He's met death. He's met it. He's met death as a closely involved observer. You think of him that day when he's in the village of Bethany. And death has wreaked havoc on a family there that Jesus knows and loves. And he sees that day firsthand what death does. The dark, dark cloud of gloom that descends on a home, on a community, on women like Mary and Martha, whom he had always known in the past as such bubbly, cheerful souls. John, in the 11th chapter of his gospel, uses strong language to express how that experience in Bethany affected Jesus. He found it harrowing. He found it disturbing. Death appalled him that day. I'm saying the risen Christ has met death as a closely involved observer. And that then feeds into this stance that he has towards it, regarding it as his enemy. But of course, he hasn't just met death as a closely involved observer, has he? He's also met death more intimately than that. He has passed actually into it, right into it. He himself has actually died. You and I don't yet know what it's like to fight for those final few breaths. We don't know what it's like for those threads tying together our bodies and our souls to start coming loose. But Jesus knows what all of that is like. At Golgotha on Good Friday, he has experienced his own life ebbing away. You think of those winds that raged last night. I bet you were all glad that you weren't camping. Imagine being in a tent, being battered by those gusts. Well, the Bible describes the body as a tent. And Jesus then knows what it's like to have a howling gale buffeting the tent of his body until that tent just gave way and collapsed altogether. Jesus, I'm saying, has really met death. And that personal meeting with it then, it's the supreme reason. That personal meeting with it at the cross, it's the supreme reason for his powerful dislike. And yes, he's risen now. Jesus Christ is risen. He's not dead. He'll never again be a dead man. But he'll always be someone who did once die. And that has marked him and shaped him and given him a loathing for vile death. Adamantly, vehemently, he regards death as his enemy. Indeed, I said before that he shares this dislike of death that all of us inevitably have. But actually, we can go further than that. His dislike trumps ours. His outstrips ours by a long way. Our dislike of death is mild compared to his. If death revolts and horrifies you this morning, know that it revolts and horrifies him more. And doesn't that endear Jesus to you? The risen Christ is not weird and unrelatable up there in heaven. He is someone who looks at the saddest, ugliest, most monstrous thing in our world, death. And he doesn't have some odd, idiosyncratic, counterintuitive take on it. No, he hates it just like you do, only he hates it more intensely than you do. Isn't that a Jesus that you want to know better? Or perhaps indeed, isn't that a Jesus that you want to get to know for the very first time this Easter? This Jesus who doesn't look indifferently upon the thing that gives you nightmares, death. But this Jesus who hates it even more than you do. This Jesus who uses the E word to describe it. It's his enemy. That's the category it's in. He loathes it. He abhors it. It repels him like nothing else. A powerful dislike. Secondly, notice with me this morning, a purposeful dominion. A purposeful dominion. So I've said that his dislike of death is more intense than ours is, but there's another difference too. His is more meaningful than ours. His is more meaningful than ours. Think of the things generally that you dislike. And some of those things you can change on the basis of your dislike of them. So if you wake up one morning suddenly finding the colour of your bedroom wall very offensive, well, you can get in the car, you can drive to B&Q, you can buy a pot of paint, you can come back home, and in a couple of hours you can change the colour of your bedroom wall. It's as easy as that. But many other things that you dislike aren't like that. You may dislike paying taxes. There's nothing you can do to change that. Not legally, anyway. You may dislike having to go to school every day. There's nothing you can do to change that. You may dislike the fact that there are speed cameras on your route to work, forcing you to crawl along at 30 miles per hour every morning. But there's nothing you can do to change that either. And our dislike of death, then, that we're talking about this morning, it's in that second category, isn't it? When it comes to this hated thing, we don't relate to it the same way we relate to our bedroom walls, from a position of power and control. No, we relate to it more like we relate to taxes and school and speed cameras, from a position of powerlessness. We can do to death the same things that we might do to speed cameras. We can shake our fists at it. We can shout abuse at it. We can fantasize about smashing it to pieces. But of course, those things don't really amount to anything, do they? It's all just venting our frustration. It's all just posturing. When it comes to concrete action, when it comes to actually changing the situation, we are powerless in the face of death. Our dislike, however strong it may be, doesn't make a scrap of difference. It's inconsequential, it's irrelevant. Our hatred toward death simmers away and surges away and rages away. And death pays no attention whatsoever and continues to wreak its havoc unabated. Our dislike of death, I'm saying, it's a meaningless thing. But it's not like that with the risen Christ. With him, the situation is very different, because notice verse 25 talks about him reigning. Not R-A-I-N, R-E-I-G-N. It talks about him reigning, and Paul doesn't mean by that that the risen Christ reigns over a particular nation or people or region. No, he means that the risen Christ reigns over everything. Literally, everything. And that includes death. I want you all to be clear on this morning. The risen Christ exercises today a limitless authority. He has dominion, to use that word from my heading. And his dominion stretches as far as reality itself stretches. It is all encompassing. And death, therefore, lies within it. Death, hear me on this, death lies within the dominion of the risen Jesus Christ. But did you notice that other word in my heading? Purposeful. A purposeful dominion. By which I mean, the risen Christ doesn't reign over everything in order to maintain the status quo. In order to keep things as they are, in order to keep the universe ticking over, basically in its present form. No. He rules over everything in order to effect change. In order to achieve a radical goal. In the language of our text, the goal of his dominion is putting all his enemies under his feet. Now, relate that to our first point this morning. What did we say then is one of the risen Christ's enemies? We said death is. So follow the logic here then. The risen Christ reigns in order to put all his enemies under his feet. I defeat them, conquer them. Death is one of the risen Christ's enemies. Therefore, the risen Christ reigns in order to put death under his feet. The risen Christ reigns in order to put death under his feet. And do you see what I mean then about his dislike of death being far more meaningful than ours? He doesn't relate to death the way that you and I relate to a speed camera. He isn't reduced to pointless fist shaking and verbal abuse in the face of death. No, he relates to death the way that you and I relate to the decor in our bedrooms, from a position of power and control. He can change the situation. He can take practical action. He can follow through on his dislike of death. He can get rid of the vile thing. Indeed, there's a necessity about him doing so, Paul says here. Notice that word must. He must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. You might say to your child, if you're a parent, I want you to tidy your room. You must stay there until it's completely tidy. Not only until most of the stuff has been put away, but even until the last most awkward things have been put away. The things right in the corner, the things that have slipped down behind the bed. You're not coming out until it's all away. And God has said to the risen Christ, you must keep on reigning until all your enemies are under your feet. Not only until most of them are, but even until the last, most awkward enemy of all is under your feet. Death. But thankfully with the risen Christ, unlike perhaps with your child, there's no reluctance. He doesn't want to be doing something else instead. Because as we said in our first point, he abhors death as much as God the Father, who has put him on the throne to defeat death, abhors death. And this purposeful dominion of the risen Christ then, do you see what this means? It means that the game is up for death. That might sound like a terribly pretentious thing to say. And on any other basis than the one on which I'm saying it, it would be a terribly pretentious thing to say. But given that the death-hating risen Christ now reigns, specifically with a view to defeating all his enemies, it's not pretentious to say this. It's reasonable. It's true. The game is up for death. Death has had it. For death, the writing is well and truly on the wall. A powerful dislike, a purposeful dominion, but we must move on. Thirdly, and notice a particular definition, a particular definition. So what exactly does Paul mean that death is going to be put under the risen Christ's feet? Or that death is going to be destroyed, as he puts it in verse 26? Or those synonyms that I used a moment ago. I talked about death being defeated. I talked about death being conquered. Well, what exactly does all this mean, this language that we're using in relation to death? You know how it is. Sometimes an announcement is made of some medical breakthrough. They think that they've discovered a cure to some disease or other. And it may be then that you have that disease. And the announcement then, from your perspective, is certainly very welcome. But at the same time, you think to yourself, it's probably too late to benefit me. It'll help others who get the disease after the cure has been brought in, and that's great, but it's too late to benefit me. Well, is it like that with this defeat of death that Paul is talking about? And whenever then it actually happens, and the risen Christ does put death under his feet, for people then, and thereafter, it'll be great. They won't experience death. But for all of us who live and who die before that moment, it's going to be too late to benefit us. Is that how we should understand the situation? Well, no, Absolutely not. Paul is not saying that when the risen Christ puts death under his feet, death will not then be able to claim new victims. I mean, that's true, but that's not really what Paul is saying. No, he's saying that when the risen Christ puts death under his feet, death will then have to surrender its old victims. That's what Paul is saying. That is to say, he's talking about resurrection. That's what he means in this language of putting under feet and destroying. He's talking about resurrection. Hopefully you couldn't miss that when I read a large chunk of this chapter earlier in the service. It's what it's all about. I said that before I read it. 1 Corinthians 15 is all about resurrection. Now, resurrection is not a vague concept. It's a very, very specific concept. Resurrection is the full restoration of bodily life. It's not some vague afterlife, some floating around somewhere beyond death in some form or other. Resurrection is very specifically the full restoration of bodily life. And the risen Christ then, at the very end of history, is going to make that happen. He's going to bring about resurrection. He gave previews, didn't he, when he was here on earth? I mentioned earlier in this sermon, John 11 and Lazarus. And you remember then how impressively Jesus goes up to that tomb and he commands in a formidable voice, "Lazarus, come out." And Lazarus comes out. And it's a preview, but when it happens on this future day, it's going to be far better than what happened on that day in the village of Bethany. Did you notice the last few verses of our reading earlier on this morning? There in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 42 and 43, Paul describes what these resurrection bodies, these resurrected bodies, are going to be like. What is sown, so he means they're what they are like now, our bodies, and we all know this, perishable. When they're raised, imperishable. Now, he says, they're characterized by dishonor. They're shameful things, humiliating things, these bodies of ours. Then, glory will characterize them. Now, weakness. We all know that, don't we? We feel like our bodies are falling apart sometimes. They're so weak. They are those flimsy tents being battered by gales. Then, he says, power. Raised in power. Far better than the previews when Jesus was here on earth. And so we must be clear then what Paul is talking about in this language of the risen Christ putting death under his feet and the risen Christ destroying death. He's not being vague here. No, this has a very particular definition. What he means is that on the last day of history, Jesus Christ is going to raise people from their graves. Bodies are going to emerge. Impressively, magnificently, thrillingly, bodies are going to emerge from their graves. To that degree, death is going to be defeated. It's not just that it can't any longer claim new people. It's got to surrender its old people. All who it has swallowed up. All who it has devoured. It's got to give them back to Jesus. And lay them at Jesus' feet on that day. That's what Paul is talking about. This is true defeat. This isn't just a setback for death. This is death well and truly ending up under the feet of our Lord Jesus Christ. A powerful dislike, a purposeful dominion, a particular definition. But then one more thing before we close. A pressing decision. A pressing decision. Because we've talked then about Christ having these enemies that are going to end up under his feet. And we focused on death as being one of those enemies that is going to end up under his feet. But it's enemies, in the plural. There's not just one enemy. There are enemies. What are those enemies of Christ that are going to end up under his feet? Well, there's death, certainly, and other kind of impersonal things like death, all the things that shouldn't be in this creation of God's, all the nasty things, illness and disease and famine and war, the thorns and thistles that are talked about right at the beginning of the Bible, all those things that blight our world and that damage our world and that are undesirable presences in our world. All of those things are Christ's enemies, and they are all going to end up beneath his feet. But it's pretty clear when you read the Bible that there are other enemies beyond that. There are personal enemies. There are enemies that have minds and individualities. Satan is an obvious example. He is going to end up beneath Jesus' feet. And all the other angels that are on Satan's side, they too are going to end up defeated, conquered beneath Jesus' feet. But we can't stop there. There are many human beings as well who, sadly, tragically, must be described using the E word. They are enemies of Christ. And it may even be that there are human beings in this room this morning who are in that category. It may be that you are an enemy of Christ, and perhaps you're thinking, well, you know, I don't have any big problem with Christ. I don't shake my fist at him. I'm not his enemy, not in this antagonistic relationship with him. But you see, this is the thing. At the end of the day, there are only two ways of relating to Christ. You are his friend who worships him and serves him and lives for him, or you are his enemy. There's no in between. There's no kind of being on the fence. There's no kind of having a decent relationship with Jesus that's neither particularly good or particularly bad. You're either his friend or you're his enemy. You either bow to the king who has the right for every knee being bowed to him, or you stubbornly refuse to bow the knee to him, in which case you're his enemy. And it may be then that you cannot approach this text that we've been looking at this morning, rejoicing in this great theme that Jesus' enemies are going to be under his feet one day, the way that we've been celebrating that and saying what a good thing that is. It may be that you're one of those enemies destined to be under his feet that day. And that is a terrifying, terrifying thing. And it doesn't have to be like that. And I want to close then this morning pleading with you. If you have not bowed the knee to Jesus Christ as your King, if you have not surrendered your life to him as your Lord, and are therefore by definition his enemy, if that is you, don't let that situation continue another day, another hour, another minute longer. You mustn't be his enemy. It's disastrous. You're going to end up where Satan ends up, where cancer ends up, where death ends up, under his feet, conquered, defeated for all eternity. You need to be his friend. You need to be on his side. You need to bow the knee to him. And then you can look forward with joy and hopeful expectation to the day when all nasty things, including even death, will be under his feet. And you can say, I won't be. I deserve to be, but I won't be, because I've come to Jesus and he's my King and he's my friend and he's my Savior. Please make sure this morning that you are on Jesus' side, and you therefore can look forward to the day that is coming when everything ugly and everything repulsive and even that wretched enemy death will be placed once for all under Jesus' feet. You can look forward. to resurrection itself. Amen.